hiding under a rock somewhere, you can't possibly, how do I put it? If you're under a rock somewhere, then you wouldn't realize that the earth, you know, the planet, the whole thing of the human race, we are quickly now sliding into a time of chaos and confusion. And that is part of the plan that Satan wants for the world. And so we're going to talk about this a little bit more today. And again, understand I can't possibly cover it all, but I'm just trying to hit some of the highlights for you. So this again is the kingdom of men my left. Anyway, where it says Daniel, king of men, that's be left on my screen. That is how Nebuchadnezzar saw human governments. And then Daniel had a dream. You see how the way God showed him about governments, human government. And there's really a contrast there. So here's Daniel. He's getting a kink in his neck like I get, because he's always been looking up. No, I won't say he's saying things are looking up. I'm not going to say that. So anyway, we want to learn more about the Roman Empire finally collapsed after centuries of, you had basically 500 years of, as a republic, and they did remarkably well considering they're human beings. They did remarkably well. But because they still have human nature, Rome over the centuries became more and more corrupt to where finally the emperors were actually selected by generals and over the various legions. And whoever could win with his generals behind him, he would pay them big money to get them in office. Maybe they would become the new emperor. And finally, though, the whole system became so corrupt that it disintegrated from within. And that's pretty much what happens. And so after Rome collapsed, it literally seemed like the end of the world for everybody, because Rome had been around so long. It had been the center of culture, especially from a human perspective. And now they are now beginning to drift in what would later be called the Dark Ages, where a lot of information, a lot of wisdom, some not good wisdom, but a lot of wisdom, a lot of information would be lost at this time. And to this day, we still don't know probably what some of the things that they did. The only thing that pops in my mind, I think I may have mentioned it before, is they had a type of cement that would set up underwater, and apparently in some places it's still fine. It still works after a couple thousand years. I'd like to have that kind of cement on my driveway. Mine's got cracks everywhere, so anyway. So then, and we will not talk about this a whole lot today, but next time, God willing, we'll do it. When Rome collapsed, and I'll show you some quotes right from a book my mother gave me, bless her heart, when I was up at Oregon. And it was written by a priest who's a historian, amazingly open about how the Catholic Church, first of all, was mistreated as well as other Christians. I should say real Christians and them. But then when Constantine had a conversion, which is very dubious, then Christianity became the religion of the empire. But anyway, so now the empire has collapsed. There's just chaos everywhere in Europe. And so Emperor Justinian from the Byzantine was the first revival of the Roman Empire. So we'll get into more details. I'm going to kind of go quickly through this first part, and then we'll get some more detail. But just like every other attempt to save Rome, it didn't really last too long. Charlemagne came along. That guy likes diamonds or whatever that is in his crown. This is the second revival of the Roman Empire. We'll get into more details as we go through this. And we'll see as we go look at some of the prophecies of Daniel, that the beast would receive a deadly wound, in other words, Rome, but it would be, if you, I'm going to paraphrase here, be resurrected, and that would be, and I'll show you that in the book that I'm being with you that I got from my mother, where they admit that the Catholic Church went ahead and adopted the Roman style of governance. So instead of having a Caesar, you have a pontiff. And they would know that term in ancient Rome. The College of Cardinals instead of like a Senate on the menu and so forth. But anyway, the point is, this was that had the deadly wound and it looked like it, the whole system was dead, but it was revived in a theological manner. But it didn't stop there. There's always been this urge to revive the Roman Empire and get Europe back to its glory days. Charles V, the fourth revival of the Roman Empire, we'll get into him just a little bit. You all know this guy. Napoleon is the fifth revival of the Roman Empire. And we'll get into some detail on that as we go through here. And then of the Third Reich, Hitler proclaimed Germany's Third Reich, envisioning a new German Empire that would rival the Holy Roman Empire established by Otto the Great. We'll get into Otto in just a minute. I think he should have already been shown. But now Otto was a German. No, Charlemagne, I believe, was a German. We'll get into that in a minute. Anyway, and how long did he say that the Third Reich would last? 1,000 years. Where do you think he got that? And he wanted world peace just his way. And Melvin Rhodes has a really good blog. You might check that out if you don't already do it. And he's an international traveler, you know, for years. He's lived in Europe. He's lived in different parts of England and Europe and in Africa. So he's well-traveled, and he understands the international look of this. In one of his articles, which I will bring up next time, he comments that everything that Hitler wanted for the Third Reich, Germany now has. But they didn't have to go to war for it. And just the way history has worked out, and we'll get into this, how Germany is the political powerhouse and the economic powerhouse of Europe. And that's really what he wanted. But again, he had his way, and if you were a Jew or anybody else that he didn't like, you would be sent to the camps. But I'm just showing you there's this desire in Europe to revive this ancient system that the scripture says would receive a deadly wound, but then it would come back. And this is sort of the EU flag. Now, one of the problems they're now finding out, and we'll get into this in just a second, is when a nation joins the European Economic Union, they surrender a lot of their sovereignty. You now are being absorbed into this system. And that's what's happened with Greece. Anybody been following what's going on in Greece? Okay, we'll show you a real short little video, pretty quick here. It's done in a comical way, but it explains what's wrong with Greece and with the new EU. Right now, it looks like unless something major happens, the whole dream of a European superpower is falling apart. Well, we know it won't, it may fall apart there, but it will revive again. We see through glass dimly, so we have to kind of do some broad brushings of history, so we can get a feel of what's happening. And that's what I'm doing these sermons for, just so you get a feel, of this material. And I know if you haven't, read the prophecy booklets for a while, I would suggest you do. I really learn a lot when I reread it. I don't know if it's something that's going on in my head now. I forget, and then I read it and go, oh, okay. So anyway. Anybody think what that might be about? The tree was cut down, and then a band set around it, and eventually that band will break off, and then you'll have the new Roman power. We'll get into that next time. This is like a little advertisement. Greece agrees to tighten her belt financially. But the problem is that since they've lost their sovereignty in Greece, they have nothing to say. What's the scripture say? The man who owes, the debtor owes the person he borrowed the money from. You're his slave. And so they are a slave now to the European market. Some feel if they would just get out and start all over, it might be the best thing for them and for Europe. But right now, other nations are waking up and saying, man, if Greece doesn't have the sovereignty that it used to have, what about us? Remember, this is a group of nations that are mixed with clays. We'll get into a little bit. And there are whole groups of different groups of people who never have gotten along historically anyway. As you know, the Germans and the Russians hate each other. After World War II, for a good reason. The French don't like the English. They don't like the, all these different things. They don't like each other. And yet they want to become economically powerful like the United States. And they thought they were well on their way to that. But right now the whole thing is on the verge of collapsing. And it may. And that may mean we just, there's more time and we need to sort of see what's going to happen here. Because when they got that common currency, that now made them the largest economic unit in the world. And they still are, but it's quickly running into problems. Right now in Greece, the people voted no on the austerity plan, where they would have to cut back. And what is happening is Germany, who is one of the biggest contributors to all these indebted nations, they're saying, you've got to do this because we're not going to pay you an endless amount of money and you can't pay us back. And so that's part of why you see the Nazi thing there, is they really feel that the Germans are being too strict and too harsh. And some of these austerity plans, one thing they did, and it started riots, like you see here, is when we had the big breakdown in 2008, the economy went down, the governments came in and propped up the banks. Now the debts are so huge, that can't be done. And so how will the banks, and this is what they tried to do in Greece, and they ran into more riots, and that is, they would say, anybody who has X number of dollars in the bank, we want 10% of it. And they just take it out of your account. Then the bank has that money. When you have a negative interest rate, you got to get the money from somewhere. They take money out of your account, notify you and say, thank you very much. It now belongs to the bank because the bank is trying to stay solvent. And there's some move of wanting to do that in the United States. But I think they're trying it in Texas. It probably wouldn't go over too good. We don't need that one. And there's our friend again. What did he see? Now, is the book of Daniel true? There's a lot of so-called scholars who say no, and they say Daniel's testimony challenges the critics. But let's first consider the nature of the critics' approach. They dispute Daniel's authorship because he refers to himself in the early chapters in the third person as if writing about someone else. However, the expositor's Bible commentary, which I think would be a good one if you don't have it, might be good to get. Not everything in it's right, but they give you a lot of history and different things. And they point out that this, quote, was customary among ancient authors of historic memoirs. Now, when the Gospels were written, they did not do that. But they didn't look at it as historic memoirs. They were just trying to preserve what Jesus taught and so forth. So that was kind of poo-pooed. That one booklet right here, Middle East and Prophecy, would be a good one. We have some on the back table if you haven't yet read it. Pick it up and look at it. Now, some have wondered, should we spend almost every Sabbath, and of course we've been here a couple weeks we're doing this, and we just need to talk about this and talk about this and talk about this. No, because that's not our emphasis. The emphasis is growing in the Spirit, understanding God's nature, overcoming sin and so forth. But we do also have to talk about this so we can be kind of aware of what's going on in the world. So is it a true book or not? Here's what this Middle Eastern Bible Prophecy, this is a UCG publication, but they quote this other author. So they're just quoting this book. Rather than admit that his words were indeed inspired, they, the critics, simply labeled his work a fraud. They claimed that it was not written by Daniel in the 6th century BC, timing which evident by events written in the book, but that it was penned by an unknown author around 160 BC. Now, who that guy was, we don't know. Any proof we got that? I don't know. Long after many of the events prophesied in the book have come to pass. This, the critics allege, is the real position, the real reason for the book's startling prophetic accuracy. So they say it is accurate, but it was written after the fact and they made it to make them look good. Well, this is a little more convoluted, but we'll read it. It says, Old Testament historian Eugene Merle says their beliefs are the critics' beliefs are built on feeble evidence. Daniel's rhetoric and language are intimately at home with the 6th century B.C. It is only on the most subjective and circular lines of evidence that the man and his writings have been denied. In other words, they have circular reasoning. This guy who wrote this book, Kingdom of Priests, he says you can trust Daniel. Okay. Let's go to Daniel. Let's see what he talks about himself. Let's go to Daniel now. And do you want to show you a couple things of what the critics were saying that really bothered them? Daniel 7, verse 15. I, Daniel. So he's mentioning himself, which we know from some other scholars saying, well, this isn't unusual for this time period if it's a historical memoir. I myself was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. Now, again, God is wanting him to show that I'm nothing special, but the God of heaven has given this to me. Now I'm going to go to Nebuchadnezzar, whoever it was that he was going to give them the truth. But he had to make sure everybody knew it wasn't him dreaming it up, but that the one true God had given it to him, and he was there, but he had to kind of identify himself in that way. I came near to the one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of this, and he told me, make it known to me the interpretation of these things. And then talks about the beast and all of that. But the point is here, and you can see these other verses, and I'm not going to spend time going into it, but hopefully you will, where he mentions, I, Daniel, this, I, Daniel, that, because it's a book of witness that I'm Daniel, I'm the servant of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're in captivity, but that God has shown me these things. So he's really identifying who he is at that level. And then we're kind of back here. The first revival of the Roman Empire was known as the Imperial Restoration. Europe has always wanted Rome to be revised. And so we had these different, some of them were tin-horn dictators, as most emperors were. But still, there was that desire there. So in Constantinople, the empire to the west, if I remember right, Rome split, right? So Rome itself was taken into captivity. The Ostrogoths and other Germanic tribes eventually ran and took over the city of Rome and all that. But in Constantinople, the leadership and the power, the money, all that moved to Constantinople. So this was the first attempt to keep the revival, keep the Roman Empire alive. And more and more the church would find itself involved in that. Justinian's whole policy was directed towards the establishment of the absolute power of the emperor and towards the revival of a universal Christian Roman Empire. This was the dream. Of course, it's been very difficult to get it to last at any amount of time. Charlemagne, as we've already said, the second revival of the Roman Empire, Pope Leo III crowned him in St. Peter's Basilica. Now, why do that? Why would the Pope do that for the king, the new emperor? Well, it's telling people that we have the authority to grant this. So, under our authority, we're accepting him at this level. To be the new emperor of the revived Roman Empire. And this was done in 800 AD. Langer's Encyclopedia of the World refers to this time as the revival of the Roman Empire in the West. So remember he said in the East it was dying, in the West it was growing. Otto was the first great emperor. He's a German. We'll come back to that in a little bit. Is White okay? Yeah. The third revival of the Roman Empire after Charlemagne's death, his grandson divided up the empire. And then that's just politics again. They all want to get in. The empire was weak and divided until Otto the Great, this fella here, crowned by the Pope again, another Pope, John the 12th, in 962, and received the title Roman Emperor that year. He was a German, and again, we'll see the significance of that. This was the third of the seven prophecies of the revival of the Roman Empire. And all this is in our literature, and I, by just time constraints, have to kind of brush over it. And this is when Charles V, we don't hear much about him, but it's some interesting things. The fourth revival of the Roman Empire, from his father, Charles inherited the vast Habsburg possessions, and the Habsburg family still exists today. The Habsburg possessions of Central Europe, Germany and Italy. Again, see where Germany's kind of playing in there. In Italy, where Rome is, and so forth. From his mother, daughter of the famed Spanish monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabel. What are they famous for? They financed Christopher Columbus's trip over here. And what they wanted was a lot of money, gold. Everybody thought there was gold basically for the picking over here. And they found out that that wasn't the case. And they did that in South and Central America as well. And then at the same time, 1492, what did I just say? Sailed the ocean blue. Columbus sailed the ocean blue. That same year, Spain ejected all the known Jews out of Spain. Told them to get out. Interesting. Remember when God said, I will bless you, but he who curses you will be cursed. He who blesses you will be blessed. So it is interesting to note that Spain, after they ejected the Jews from there, was never a major economic power again. So anyway, he inherited Spain and its American possessions. Oh, wait a minute. There you go. Determined to realize the age-old dream of a unified Europe. See, this has been going on for years, not just in our lifetimes. A unified Europe. Charles V's reign was the pinnacle of the fourth prophesied revival of the Roman Empire. Quote, one of the greatest of the kings of Spain and the Holy Roman Emperor. That's what he was called. Charles V was perhaps the last emperor to attempt to realize the medieval idea of a unified empire embracing the entire Christian world. He wanted, of course, that would have been in Europe, South and Central America. This comes from the Encyclopedia Britannica, 15th edition, blah, blah, blah. Okay, somebody. The fifth empire. Now we kind of getting closer to our time. It is interesting, this fella and the one that came after him learned not, well, they learned the hard way, do not attack Russia in September, when Hitler, well, you get into Hitler a little bit later, but Napoleon did the same thing. They just couldn't imagine how tough Russian winters are. They are miserable. But if you live there and you're used to it, fine. I believe like 90% of his army died trying to get out of Russia. They died of starvation, freezing to death. So Napoleon Bonaparte was to lead the fifth prophesied attempt to resurrect the Roman Empire with the endorsement of the Roman Church. See, now the Church is always in here, got its hand in this thing. And again, as I mentioned to you before, you can see these quotes are not from church material. These quotes are from other historical sources. And there are lots and lots of Bible scholars and commentaries who agree with the Church of God on these empires. Now, the other areas, we go off into la-la land with some of them, but it's pretty clear how this was done. As Will Durant observed, Napoleon, quote, dreamt of reviling, Yeah, that one. Charlemagne and uniting Western Europe, then of following Constantine. So they wanted to just continue this whole process to the capture of Constantine or Constantinople, and proposed the revival of Alexander by conquering India. In other words, they just want to keep this empire growing. And again, probably the most evil man on earth, those who had the misfortune of being in the room with him when he was angry, they'd say, they could see, and these people aren't religious, they said, something gets a hold of him. And there's our leaders like this. And I really, this is just my opinion, I don't have any way of proving it, that at times Satan the devil would get into him. And I mean, these battle-hardened generals and stuff, they were terrified of him for a while anyway. So Adolf Hitler proudly proclaimed Germany's Third Reich, because the World War I was the Second Reich, envisioning a new German empire that would rival the Holy Roman Empire, the German nation established by Otto the Great. So there we go, Otto, remember him? He was a German building up the 6th and 7th imperial revivals foretold in Revelation 17. We'll get into it in just a minute. I have to give you this background. More details of the fourth beast. So we sort of see in a real brief there the various revivals and the attempted revival, and there's yet one more. And right now it's not going too well for them. What will it take for this final revival of the Roman Empire to come up? We could guess, we could speculate, but that's all it would be. So the church says, instead of trying to figure out exact dates and times, because nobody's right in the end, watch what's going on in the world around you so you be alert and attentive. Wow, this whole thing is about to collapse in Europe. We'll get it here in just a second. What will happen? Well, we know it will revive one more time. And here's what it says in this article, The Four Empires of Daniel's Prophecies from the United Church of God. More details for, quote, four beasts, a lion, that would be Babylonian Empire, a bear, the Medo-Persian Empire, a leopard, Greco-Macedonian Empire, and the fourth beast described as terrible and unlike the other three. Daniel 7:7 says that this about the fourth creature, and then Daniel 7:7 reads this, quote, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth, paralleling the iron legs of the prior dream. It was devouring, breaking into pieces, and trampling the residue with his feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And again, I'm not going to try to explain every little bit. We'll get into the overview, and you can read the literature, which would be really good, so you can get it all. So Daniel 7:7. This is another vision that Daniel had in Daniel 7, verse 7. Let's turn there. Daniel 7, verse 7. After I saw in the night vision, this is Daniel speaking, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It just stomped over everybody. And you saw that with the physical Roman Empire. Towards its end, they were just really, really, really brutal people. And it has that whole thing. So that's really what he's seeing there. So Daniel takes us back to the future. Remember that movie, Back to the Future? Daniel's book prophesied events fulfilled many centuries ago, as well as major events yet to come. And again, that one, Expositor's Bible Dictionary or Commentary, I would suggest you get it because they break that down in pretty good order. You know, I wouldn't bet my salvation on every little word, but it gives you some pretty good order of these things. It reveals a history of the region written in advance from Daniel's time up to the return of Jesus Christ. It's the most panoramic prophecy in the scriptures. And Daniel, a very humble man, God would show him these things. And Daniel had to witness to and deal with the first two leaders of one is Babylon and the other is the Greco-Macedonian. So the Hebrew name was David, renamed Belshazzar by the Babylonians. We've read that last time, Daniel 1, verse 1 through 7. Daniel lived in the remarkable times of the downfall of the kingdom of both Judah and Babylon. He lived to see that. He served as a high officer in both Babylonian government and its successor, the Medo-Persian Empire. These empires during this time really valued soothsayers, people who say they know what the gods are teaching them. And yet really the only one that was really doing that was the ones that God had chosen with Daniel and his partners with him, the other Jewish captives. Yet at the end of the book, God instructs Daniel to shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. That's chapter 12, 4. This indicates that certain major prophecies that previously wouldn't have been made sense will be understandable at the end, as the end approaches. So we are waiting to see. We're all kind of wondering who the king of the south is. It's some speculation over the years, but it certainly appears that who those two are is now coming to the fore. And we'll get into that as we do that. Phenomenal prophecy and fulfillment. And this is from this booklet, Middle Eastern Prophecy. The accuracy of Daniel's prophecies of remotely distant events is spectacular. For example, the 70 weeks prophecy, which I'm not going to get into, recorded in Daniel 9, 24 through 27. Daniel predicts the precise year of Christ's appearance, not his birth, but his appearance, and the beginning of his ministry in AD 27. That's expositors, but it's also in that literature that we put out in this booklet. That was written down there way before. British historian Paul Kennedy, this is the book that he wrote in his book. British historian Paul Kennedy, who now lectures at Yale, wrote a monumental book called The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. And uncharacteristically, I'm getting my tongue all tangled here today, accurate. In it, looking back to the 1500 years, he showed that the qualities that lead to nations rising to power and the reasons for their decline and fall have certain commonalities. Start off with the desire to, you know, like in Rome, the family was very, very important. People had more character. They certainly weren't converted, but they had more character. And by the time Rome finally disintegrated from within, and then the German tribes just came in and cleaned up. So there are commonalities. And one of them is building an empire, a world empire. Britain did it, and by the end of World War I, they were almost broke, and then World War II came and finished them off. They've never really been the power that they used to be. They lost their possessions. Among them were the colonies of the United States. And he also points out, and we'll see this a little bit later, that the other thing is, by maintaining large standing armies around the world, which Rome did, and frankly, which the United States does, and then spend, and that's what they do, not only just for the government, but for everything else. That's what finally breaks the character of the people, goes down and down and down. All they want to do is be entertained. The government will spend whatever it takes to try and meet those goals so they can put off a revolution. Now, we'll be seeing this in Daniel 7 and Revelation 17, more of a description of this. Let's go to Daniel 7, verse 1. The first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and the visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Okay, this is it. Daniel spoke, saying, I was in my vision by night, and behold, four winds of heaven were stirring up a great sea. It would be probably the Mediterranean Sea. And four great beasts came out from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, so you can see the lion there. That would be Babylon. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. And so that you have some interesting
paintings of that kind of stuff, a lion with eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off and was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, for man's heart was given to it.
So instead of just being an animal, now he stood up as a human being, was given the mind of a human being. So it's a human kingdom.
And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear.
So
this would be the Medo-Persian Empire. Okay? And these two are people, these two empires, Daniel dealt with the leadership, at least the early leadership of both of these empires. He was there a long, long time. And the sad thing is he never got to go back to Jerusalem. You know, he wanted to be there, but no, he had to stay there.
And he was not living in abject poverty. He was living pretty high on the, I won't say hog, pretty high on the calf, you know, because he got good reports from the kings and like, but he couldn't go back.
And suddenly, another beast, a second like a bear, he was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in his mouth, and it gets into the a little battle that went on, and we'll talk about this in just a second. After this, I looked, and there was another, verse 6, like a leopard. This would be Greece under Alexander the Great. And again, almost all commentaries agree with this. It's clear when you look at history and how they moved, you see this. So you see the leopard. That would be Alexander the Great, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads. And a dominion was given to it. And I saw in the night vision, and behold, a 4th beast, dreadful.
Now we read that dreadful and terrible. This would be the revival of the Roman Empire.
9 through 14. Now, let's go to chapter 7, verse 9. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days seated. In other words, he's seeing this in a vision. His garment was white as snow, and his hair on his head was like pure wool. So this is talking about Christ. His throne was a fiery flame. Its wheels were burning fire. And that's how it looked to him. It was bright and some kind of movement. He had to write it in the terms that he could. You know, other prophets, they say, all these grasshoppers are coming. Yet, if you look some of the modern military helicopters, they look like grasshoppers. See? So he had to write down what he was seeing. He was seeing a modern instrument of war, but he doesn't know what an X-12 super duper helicopter is. He just said it looks like a locust or even a grasshopper. A fiery stream issued out forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. This is the glorified throne. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books opened. And now Christ is back and the judgment of the nations begin. Verse 11. I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. So the pompous words, this talks about a religious leader and who has insults God, insults, and you see a type of that with Antiochus Epiphany. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As to the rest of the beasts that he saw, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season. Okay. I was watching in the night, verse 13, visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. That's what we read in Acts, remember, on Pentecost. He became the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. And all the peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. Now that prophecy just covered several thousand years. But he's saying the system was going to die, and God is returning with, and Christ is going to set up the kingdom. Let's go to, for time's sake, Revelation 17. It's interesting. Here we go, years and centuries later. John sees these things, and he says, wow, they all kind of go together, don't they? Revelation 17.
Yeah.
17. Verse 12. The sixth angel poured out his bowl. See, this is why I can't do all of these, cover every little scripture. But maybe with these sermons, you could go back and read the literature, because it's really important that you, and I'm telling myself this too, that you renew your understanding of this. Not that we understand every little thing, how everything's going to work out, because we don't. But we do know that we, if you hang on, no matter how bad it gets, that we will be ruling with Christ, is what these prophecies are saying. But we have to hang in there tight. Then the sixth angel poured out his bowl in the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up, and so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. So the river is dried up so the armies can pass through. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, one of the mouth of the beast, and one out of the mouth of the false prophet. So there's this union here used in this revival, the final one. Well, it still works for me. Thank you. I wrote it down right, I just didn't read it right. Okay, thank you. Verse 12. There's always some dissonant in every room. The ten horns which you saw are kings who have received no kingdom as yet. During the time in which the vision was given, they didn't have that yet. But they received authority for 1 hour as king with the beast. So this is yet in the future. There have been all these attempted revivals we just briefly talked about. But at the very end, this system will be alive. And we'll see here what it's going to do. Verse 13, these are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. All the sovereignty of those nations, they give over to this system. And it's a charismatic leader. Okay? These all make war with the Lamb. That tells us when it's going to be, doesn't it? Christ is the Lamb. They make war with the Lamb, who overcomes them, for He is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him, that's us, are called the chosen and faithful. Then He said to me, the waters which you saw, where the harlot sits, are peoples, multitudes, and nations and tongues all around. So there's coming this revival which will engulf the whole world. And we'll see in just a minute that the holy people, for a while, will be defeated, or they're going to be losing the struggle with this system. It doesn't mean they give up their faith, but it means they're going to prison. They're losing out on everything. We'll see that in just a few minutes. And then the ten horns which you saw, the verse 16, on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and turn with fire, and burn with fire. Eventually, those who teamed up with this system, more and more of them will see they bought into a lie and they're angry and they'll come back and try to destroy her that way. And that will be, if we understand it correctly, and I'll cover that next time, probably China will be a part of that. When you have 1 billion people, you can have a pretty hefty army. And anyway, for God put it into their hearts to fulfill His purpose, to be of one mind, so God is orchestrating this revolt against this Roman system to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God be fulfilled. So anyway, let's move on. Daniel and his visions. Daniel 11. Let me make sure I get into Daniel 11. I know some of you think, what about this verse? What about that verse? I can't get them all. Daniel 11. Well, I know. I don't have my trusty light on. Daniel 11 and verse 35. Let me just start in verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. So there's going to be a large contingent of people who will walk away from the covenant of having a relationship with God. And that can be in the church or out of the church. But there will be in the church. And again, I don't have anybody in mind, but if you just run the numbers, in every congregation there will be some who will join the system because it would simply be too hard not to. And then there's always those, you know, it doesn't matter. They're not going to leave. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. This is the great false prophet. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. Probably you will see a lot of miracles, really powerful, inspired, and I think extemporaneous, either speeches or witnessing to people. We'll see. Of course, the two witnesses will have their job too during this time. And those are the people who understood shall instruct many. See? So during this time, that's why it's important for you and I to get caught up on this. We're going to be instructing many. And you may want to go through some of this material and say, remember when this happened? Well, that's what it said, it would happen here. And we're going through this terrible time now, but let me remind you, we'll show you some things here that you want to remind them of. We will instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. And that includes some of God's true people. Now when they fall, they shall not be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And again, check out something here. By flattery. Whoever this beast power will be, he's not going to be like an obstinate, evil Hitler. I mean, he just turned your stomach. This guy is going to be a slick talker. You know, maybe the used car salesman. I don't know. But anyway, he will be probably very nice on the surface. Speak impeccably. He's going to do miracles. All of these kind of things. And even so much for that you can even deceive the very elect. See, we've got to know that can happen. But he shall fall by the sword and by captivity and plunder. Verse 34. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them in this. I just read that to you, in this endeavor. And some of those who of understanding shall fall. I said what I said, just from the numbers. There's going to be a percentage that will fall because this system will be all-encompassing, very powerful, and we'll see here in just a minute, actually winning against God's people for a while. Some of those who are standing shall fall, of understanding shall fall, to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So some of those who will fall, the whole idea is here that as they go through this, all of these difficulties in their lives, we hope, and God hopes they'll repent. And again, God's always wanting repentance. He's always saying, if you repent, then, especially you go through Revelation, you look at Revelation, the different plagues that would come, it says, then it was quiet for an hour. Now, was it literally 60 minutes, or does that just mean some short period of time? I suspect it's some short period of time. And he gives people a chance to repent. And if they don't, well, then he puts them through more plagues. So that's, even in the end time, those who have understanding shall fall, and because they're weak, and God allowed that. Why? To refine them. To burn out the impurities. When you wake up in a camp somewhere, and you're under arrest, and you haven't killed anybody, but, you know, you believe in going to church on Saturday, but that maybe was it. You really haven't been living this way as you should. And God says, well, I know that's the way it is. So I'm going to let you're going to get swept up in this, going to get corrected with the idea to save them in the end. Then the king shall do according to his own will, verse 36. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, every kind of worship, deity, thing. Shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, against the true God, and shall prosper. Going to be wealthy and rich. Those that are with him will be. Remember in Revelation it says that the nations wept because they were getting rich off this system. See? I don't know if we have to see, who knows how this is all going to work out, but will we see probably a big, terrible collapse of all the economies of the world, and then this system revives and pulls the world out of that. We'll be eternally thankful to them. And shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above all. So he wants to be worshipped as a God. The Bible talks about him in Thessalonians as the man of sin. Okay, well, we don't have to get into all that. So, you had Alexander the Great, so you got that. Daniel 11:5. Is that what we want? Okay, let's go back now to Daniel 11:5. Also the king of the south shall be strong, and as one of his princes or generals, he shall gain power. Okay, who's the king of the south? We have, yes, Alexander the Great. Now I won't get into his father was murdered, and he was treated terribly, and just about disappeared into history. No one would have known who he was. But he was a brilliant young man. He died at age 23 after conquering all the known world. And he didn't quite know what to do with himself. They said he had a fever. Who knows? From where, what? I don't know. So he was roughly 23 years old. May have looked something like this. Who knows what he looked like, but at least, there you go. So after he died in 323 BC, he had no children. So he had four generals that would, they divide up the empire among themselves. Because again, he didn't have any children. And so then this series of wars and like start. Now the Greek Empire, by the time he died at age 23, this is the Greek Empire. You can see Ptolemy, where he goes, yeah, down in the left-hand corner, Ptolemy is one of the generals, and also known as the king of the south. Seleucus, king of the north. That's how they would refer to themselves. And they thought they could all kind of band together and things would work out, but because of politics, you know, somebody always wants more power and some authority, so they start fighting among themselves. And Cassander in the red. And Lysimachus is the fourth one, the little one at the very top. These two last ones I mentioned to you just sort of absorbed into the king of the north and king of the south. So that's the one here in the green, says green, Greek Empire, four kingdoms after 301 BC. The other map is just a sort of a topographical map, if you will, where it's all pink in there. Is that pink? I'm not very good with colors. Okay. That is what a 23-year-old man and his army did. And again, he dies at age 23. And so they divvied up this empire between these guys. And they start fighting among each other until it's just the two. Okay. Now, let's talk here about the king of the south and the king of the north. Now again, Islam. The Arab religious landscape was to change dramatically with the Prophet Muhammad and the religion he founded. Up to that time, Ishmael, is that right? Yes, he's the father of the Arab peoples. And they never could pull themselves together. As the Hebrew reads about what's his name? The children of who's the man? Anyway, don't be offended by this, but the scripture says that the Arab peoples And remember when God, who's the father of the, no, of Abraham's son that, Ishmael, thank you. The prophecies, and you can look it up, he said he'd be a wild man. But in the actual Greek, it says wild ass of a man. And he says that his, again, kind of like a stubborn mule, they could never get together because they're always fighting and always fighting and always fighting. Then Muhammad comes on the scene, and he really, because he was such a tough leader, you either, you know, come join our church or we'll cut your head off. And it hadn't changed a bit. So anyway, thanks for the thinking. This is the, what the popular vision or impression the people of Islam want you to believe. And probably there are lots of folks, who are in that religion who just don't want to live their life. They don't want to go kill anybody, chop anybody's heads off. They're mortified by what they see under the name of Islam. But the problem is they're so intimidated by these radicals that they're afraid to step up and try to stop it. Because they do, they get killed. So what's happening is it's just being absorbed into this whole system. So these are the five pillars of Islam in relation with spiritual and physical health. Start with faith and charity. I don't know what that other one, Hajj. And then you have prayer and fasting. Well, that's not too bad. And, well, that, you know, that's part of it. But there's another part of it. I did not put in here the actual head that was sitting on his chest after they finished. This is 6th century activity. And this is demonic. And we've already had one beheading in the United States, and it was in Kent and Oklahoma. And it's going to happen a lot more. So the Arab religious landscape has changed so dramatically, the Prophet Muhammad and the religion he founded. How many of you knew that when Muhammad first started, he wanted to ally with the Jews? Because the Jews were monotheistic, and the Arab people just, if it moved, it was a god, you know. And he didn't want to do that. And the Jews rejected him, and then from then on, they've been at each other's throats. So this is what the world is facing now. Okay. I gotta go back here. Okay, I forgot to do something. Are you ready to play those little things? Okay. Let's, use that, I don't have it here with me. Play that first one. They're in the order that you got them. We're going to see a few things and maybe help you to see that. Okay, now, this is a comical explanation of what's wrong in Europe right now. And we're, the United States is heading into the same thing. But it'll explain to you in a non-financial way. If you ever watch the financial channels, and you don't know any more than when you started. It could, you know, the gobbledygook, what? So anyway, let's listen to this. This is a sort of a comical way of explaining what's wrong with Europe. Okay, and then let's go to the number two. We have three of these. Now, he was one of the few that was saying when in 2006, he said the housing market's going to burst. And he was trying to get words in. And I think I may have showed you a video. He was on Fox or something. And he had other financial advisors there, you know, giving their 2 cents worth. And this fellow said, it's going to collapse. And when it does, it'll be the greatest collapse in our history. And the other guys were literally laughing at him, publicly laughing at him on the air. And one said, I'll bet you a dollar that this won't happen. Well, when it happened, this boy said, well, I want my dollar. He said, well, that was over a year ago, so any bet I made a year ago doesn't count. So anyway, the point is, maybe, did I ever show you the people laughing at him? And he just says, well, you laugh all you want, and it's going to happen. And he was right on the money. And now there's a whole, I studied this word, so I can say it, plethora of people in the financial world. I don't know what's going to happen. All I know is I'm going to read this stuff, study it, and try to be as ready as I can, and spiritually, emotionally, so forth. But many feel that many feel that by the end of this year, the economy will collapse. They're from different points of view. They may be totally wrong. I don't know. But it's a drumbeat among a lot of pretty informed people. We'll see. We'll see. Let's go to that last one. This is, if you go there, can you just hold it while I say a little something? How many of you have ever heard a run on a bank? When somebody has a run on a bank, what does that mean? Okay. And banks, if you put in $100, do they have 100 of your dollars there? And I put in 20 million because I'm rich, and I have 20 million. Does the bank keep all that money right in there? No. What do they do with it? They loan it out. They do all that. You buy a house, a car. They loan that out. The banks are betting on the fact that not all of you are going to go in and want your money all at once. Now, in Greece, which you'll just see, that's what is happening, and the government says, no, you have $66 a day, because they have no more money, and they're trying to figure out what to do. Businesses can't run on that. There's no way you have $66 a day and barely feed you. They're also telling pensioners, you're only going to get half of your pension or a third of your pension. And when you have that, you have the riots that I showed you a little while ago. So let's show you a run on a bank that happened 2 weeks ago. And it's the same kind of thing that happened in the 20s, where everybody ran into the bank to get their money, but they don't keep the money there. It goes into central bank system. It goes into loans and all of that. And again, remember we said that our economy is based on debt. And so as long as people are willing to buy a house, a car, whatever, well, okay. But it's pretty unusual to ever hear somebody say, I'm going to buy that house. I mean, I couldn't do it. I'm going to buy that house before I buy it. I'm going to pay for it in cash. Well, I can't. So if I'm going to own a house, what do I have to do? I'm going to go to the bank and get a mortgage. What does mortgage mean? I believe it has some, I need to look that up. Something to do with death. What's that? Mort? Okay, mort. Okay, so anyway, I just thought that was kind of funny. All right, so let's take a look at a modern run on a bank and see what it looks like. This is in Greece again. Okay, so the deal is here that the European economy is in trouble. You saw why. Remember the funny story? But that kind of explained it. And at the same time, if you listen to the news, China, their market has dropped over 30% in a month. What happened was, and it kind of sounded like what happened in the United States in the 20s, the little guy, the little guy didn't have a lot of money, but he went into debt, borrowed money from a bank or from grandma or grandpa, somebody. They borrowed their money and they went into the stock market because the stock market was growing like 150% a month. Well, let's get in on that. Well, and so they're in debt. And then when, for various reasons, the things began to slow down, production-wise, they kept producing to have the look that it's good. And they've got all this stuff stored in big buildings, hoping they can sell it. And then finally, they've had to let people go because there's no market like there used to be. Why? Because the United States is struggling. Europe is struggling. And now China is in real bad shape. So what is Chinese government's answer? Same thing all governments is. They're going to start buying those debt instruments.
So what happened? It went down even more, because if the government's got to step in and try to save the market, it's telling everybody else, we're in bad shape. So, and it's not just set up there only for the Chinese, but the Chinese, which was the second or third largest economy in the world, is collapsing. Now again, because they control the central government, they don't, it's hard to get information out. So all these things are happening in our world. And we need to keep in mind, and I hope you should read this booklet. We've got them all back there, the ones that you've seen advertised. We study this material. And you can see there's this urge, this deep desire for Europe to unite. And right now it's about to all fall apart and lose it all. What's going to happen to save it? I don't know. Does it mean it just almost has another death and then somebody comes along? Europe is struggling. The Chinese too, a little different, because the Chinese are pretty hard on any enemy. They don't worry about courts as much. They just kind of shoot you. But anyway, Europe is now being overrun by the Muslim religion. And the fastest growing religion in the United States is what? Muslim. Fastest growing is Muslim. The whole world is shifting geopolitically, financially. It's all shifting. So now do we go into some catatonic depression? No, that's not the reason for these things. The reason for these things is what we're looking at is proof that we need the second coming of Christ, because human beings still can't solve their problems. And one thing they do, it seems to create two more problems. And they come back and they do some of this. So the whole world is on a brink. And, you know, I've talked to some of you, you say, well, you know, I don't like hearing it, but we need to go through it. So let's bear down, get it done. But it's still very, very difficult. And everything around us is changing very, very rapidly. And it will impact all of our lives. And I'm telling you that, and I don't know the degree that it's going to, but it will. We've read before with this, whenever this power system starts, and the false man of sin is on the line, and you have this universal governmental system. If you want to be a part of it, you've got to go along with it. And if you want to go along with it, you have to compromise your faith. So God allows that to purify us. That's a needed thing. But keep in mind, things are not just going to go on and on and on. I hope you will take the time to meditate, read these booklets, and then just remember, God will protect us. It doesn't mean it won't be difficult. It doesn't mean you won't be persecuted. You will be. See? You will be. Well, in turn, we will go through a purification of our own, whatever level we need it. Because Christ is determined, when he comes back, to take the kingdom and give it to the people of God. And let's go to chapter 12, and we'll end here. Verse 1, this is at the time Michael, that's the archangel, shall stand up. The great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. Remember we said he's probably been in charge of protecting Israel over the years. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. That's the great tribulation. Even to that time. So this is a one historical high point, if you will, in this, not high point, but tribulation as never before. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And many of those who sleep, first resurrection, in the dust of the earth shall be awake, some to everlasting life and others to everlasting contempt. And again, we jump around on first and second resurrection. Those who are wise shall shine. And remember, the other one says, shall do exploits like the brightness of the firmament. And those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So there's that ultimate thing that we will receive. And then we'll get into some of the other things the next time I'm here. But I hope you'll look at this material not in a negative way. Be thankful that we see it through glass dimly. And watch what's going on in the world with the eye These prophecies are going to come to pass. How? Well, let's watch and see. Pray that we will be found worthy to escape, that we will be receive that extra protection and guidance in our lives as we enter into the most dangerous time in the history of the world. So it's not, and again, think of it, if God wants to use us for great exploits, that's because we're humble and just willing to say, whatever you want me to do. You know, he's also said, you know, when you are persecuted and brought before, I think he said a king or some, you know, I think that was the term. Don't worry about what you're going to say ahead of time. I'll give it to you. That's the world we live in. That's the world. And I hope that you will, don't just wait for the sermon next week, but start reading that material again. Go over it really carefully. Think about it so you'll be ready when these things really begin to take place. And it helps you to stay spiritually in tune and spiritually alert as well. All right? Well, now we, in part two, we'll have part three, God willing, next time I'm here.